Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
In Washington, where a lot of the focus here from the White House and from Capitol Hill is instead on activity we are seeing in many places across the country, from the West Coast at UCLA to north of us in Manhattan, Joe, as we've seen these pro-Palestinian protests roiling college campuses and ultimately last night police having to get involved in New York.
That's for sure. Look, no one knew exactly how that was going to go. Students who had occupied the hall on Columbia's campus, who were many of which were chanting live as we were in the late edition of Balance of Power yesterday, were cleared out. They said they would not leave without being forced to, and they certainly were. It was just after 9 p.m. If you're with us on Bloomberg TV, you can see images of police at work. They entered the building on a second floor there, and dozens were arrested, Kaylee, led away by bus to their next destination. They're trying to clear out the campus for a May 15th graduation ceremony, and it's unclear they're going to have the cooperation of all students on that.
Well, and the university has asked the police to stay present on the campus until May 17th, try to get through all of those. And this just really underscores a great political problem for this administration, as you have seen Republican lawmakers especially taking this opportunity to go to Columbia University to speak about this issue, taking action just today on anti-Semitism, we expect, in the House of Representatives. And at the same time, you have representatives of this administration and the Secretary of State in the Middle East trying to work on a ceasefire deal, which may be the only thing that could help ease this tension abroad and at home.
It's pretty remarkable. And Jordan Fabian from our White House team is framing it perfectly in his piece today, talking about the make or break moment for Joe Biden right now. And he joins us at the table. Jordan, it's always great to have you. Thanks for being here. This is a fine line that Joe Biden is walking here. Of course, the Democrat needs young people to show up to be elected, clearly. He's dealing with the strife overseas that Kaylee mentioned, and it's playing out on campuses now. How is the White House responding to questions of free speech versus security for Jewish students?
So they've issued statements through spokespeople condemning things like the seizing of the building at Columbia, any kind of violence or anti-Semitic rhetoric. Of course, there's been pressure for Joe Biden himself to come out and address this, both from Jewish groups and from Republicans in Congress. It's a tough line, as you mentioned, Joe, for him to balance, though, because on one hand, he has these young voters who, you know, it's not all young voters, but a very vocal segment who've been out there protesting his approach to the Israel-Hamas conflict. On the other hand, you have, you know, Jewish Americans, a lot of other people who are very concerned about this. And so threading the needle and sort of putting out some kind of nuanced message is something very difficult right now. So it seems like the White House is hoping that the conflict resolves itself during these ceasefire talks this week. And that really takes a pin out of the protests we're seeing across college campuses.
Well, and it also is worth noting, Jordan, that a lot of this, frankly, is not actually in the hands of the president. It is up to these universities whether or not they're going to meet demands of students in terms of divesting from Israel, for example. And it's up to other parties, namely Israel and Hamas, as well as the Egyptians and Qataris, as to whether or not ultimately a ceasefire agreement is reached. There's only so much that the president is able to do.
That's right. And you make a good point, Kaylee, which is that these protests aren't about Joe Biden, and they're not really even about the U.S. government. It's about what the universities are doing. And so whatever he says might not quell their concerns. And, you know, the Biden campaign will tell you that while we're seeing a lot of protest activity, a lot of intense feeling, this is only a small sliver of not only the U.S. electorate, but of young voters. And young voters, while they support a ceasefire, they support the end to the war, they don't rank this too highly. So there's other issues like the economy where that's going to speak more to their how they're casting their ballot in November than what we're seeing on televisions with the protests right now.
Is this his primary focus right now? When you look at Joe Biden's day, if you look at the length of time he can spend on an issue, we finally got through this whole funding process with Ukraine and Israel. We have funded the government. Obviously, he's got a campaign running. But when he's in the West Wing, is this occupying his full attention at the moment?
Absolutely. I mean, he said in public speeches that overseas conflicts, I mean, not just this, but Ukraine, that funding package you just mentioned, that's occupying the majority of his time. And it's interesting because we're in this election year. Usually you would see a president, a presidential candidate out on the road, and you're seeing him out on the road, mm-hmm. but a lot of his mental energy, a lot of the time spent yeah. behind closed doors is clearly spent on resolving this conflict. You know, he's been on the phone with the leaders of Israel, of Arab nations who are helping broker these ceasefire talks, and it's clearly weighing heavily on his mind.
Yeah. All right, Jordan Fabian, who covers the White House for us here at Bloomberg, thank you so much. We want to turn this now to our political panel, our signature political panel. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributors, are with us now. Jeannie, as Jordan is just describing here, a president that has been on the road where he has not been to this point is actually on any of these campuses that we're talking about. Does the president need to make a trip to one of these schools to talk to these students? Is he able to address this issue from afar?
You know, I think he can address it from afar. You know, these are issues for the college campuses themselves. When the protests get out of hand and they turn violent or they are anti-Semitic or they are bigoted, if they are, you know, in any way impeding somebody's ability to get an education and police are called in, absolutely the government comes in, but that is the police. The president, the Speaker of the House, they do not have a role on this. College campuses have many things to address. They've done some things right on this. They've done some things wrong. We all know that. But the reality is the president doesn't need to be on a college campus to say, I denounce anti-Semitism, I support peaceful protest, and that is something that he should be saying forcefully. But he should leave it to the officials at the college to do what we do, which is teaching students. And if the students need to have a lesson as it pertains to peaceful protest, if they need to have a lesson as it pertains to any sort of thing, that is up to the university, the board of chancellors, or whoever is in control. So I don't think the president needs to go there except to give a commencement address when invited, as he will at Morehouse in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, Rick Davis, if we're in for many more larger protests, knowing that it was congressional testimony that really got this started. We remember, of course, Harvard and MIT more recently, Columbia's leader. And now we understand that a House committee will be summoning three more university leaders, Yale, UCLA, University of Michigan. That's May 23, assuming they all testify. Rick, what will this story look like by then?
Yeah, I think that this is going to continue on through the red hot summer, right? I mean, you would have thought, oh, everybody go home after school. You know, this is finals week in many of these institutions. Maybe we just take a breather from this. But look, I mean, this isn't really about whether or not the universities are investing in Israel. I mean, for heaven's sakes, it's just such a tiny issue in the grand scheme of things. It's what's happening on these campuses that have the president engaged and others around the country, including Congress, and that is rampant anti-Zionism, rampant attacks on Jewish students in the harassment that they have to go through. I mean, this is a cultural issue that needs to be addressed. It is unacceptable behavior in virtually every single instance of these protests. They are fueled by this kind of bigoted behavior. And it is the President of the United States that sets the standard for our society to live together. And this is not the way to do it. And the universities have failed universally. If you have a protest where they've taken over your campus or your office buildings, you've by definition failed in your ability to create a positive environment for all students to learn and to get along. And so, yeah, I think this is something the president should deal with. I think Congress mm-hmm. legitimately should try as hard as they can to fight back the spread of anti-Semitism that's been well reported in our country. And I think this is a legitimate topic to be discussed, especially in the summer of a presidential election year.
Okay, so Rick, from your point of view, if this is really a cultural issue, this is not something that would have a geopolitical solution in any sense. A ceasefire agreement wouldn't bring an end to the kind of behavior or language that you are talking about that has been on display here. This actually, in your mind, is more of a domestic issue in this country, even if it originated from something that happened abroad?
Sure. I look, there's no question that any improvement in the condition on the ground in Gaza would help calm things down within our country, and other countries around the world are affected by this. But the reality is, we also know that ceasefires haven't lasted, and this one is not, even if they get it, not planned to be last forever. Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has made it perfectly clear that regardless of ceasefires, he still plans to root out the balance of Hamas, and that means ground troops from the IDF in Gaza killing Palestinian Hamas agents. And so, yeah, this isn't going away anytime soon. And yeah, we all hope and pray for a ceasefire. But I don't think anybody in this administration or in the region believes that solves all the problems.
Rick and Jeannie, Kaylee is pointing me to a tweet right now from an official at the White House, the Deputy Communications Director, that the president will deliver remarks next week on anti-Semitism, what they call a sacred duty to remember and mourn the 6 million Jews who were systematically murdered by the Nazis and their collaborators. He will deliver a keynote address at a Holocaust memorial ceremony. Jeannie, is this more what you had in mind?
It's absolutely. He is doing the right thing. He needs to denounce forcefully, as he always has, anti-Semitism in any form. There is no question. He needs to denounce violence, maltreatment, mistreatment of anyone. He also needs to support the right to peaceful protest. And I think he needs to remind people what the heart of what these young people who are out there are out there about is a war that is going to last, as Rick just talked about. They fear for the large amount of their future, and they don't feel like their government is doing enough about it. Should they do that peacefully? Absolutely. But let's not forget, this is a devastating and awful war that is going on down there, out there, and they are asking for a ceasefire. Now, protests, as they are and have always been, have a lot of different voices in them, but that is at the heart of this. And that is also something that the president and the administration are pushing for. So, you know, I think we have to give credit to young people. Anybody who has sent a child to college in the last 10, 20 years, as I have, and I teach at a college, the motto at almost every one of these American universities is change the world. That is what we teach the students to do, to think, to act. And so when people go out to make a change in their world peacefully, we support that. When they get out of line, they have to accept those consequences, and absolutely they should. What happened in New York overnight had to happen. But this is the reality we're living in, and the president is right to speak on anti-Semitism, just as I hope he speaks about the right to peacefully protest and does his job, which is pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza and helping the civilians over there who are suffering enormously on both sides of the aisle, and including, and most importantly, the hostages.
Jeannie, we have less than a minute left, but as you talk about young people changing the world also can change depending on the way people vote in November. From your vantage point, is it more likely that these young voters will just not vote at all, or that they actually would be willing to turn out and vote for Donald Trump rather than Joe Biden?
Yeah, on this issue, you know, they don't see, at least as far as we can tell so far, Donald Trump as a viable option, because, of course, he's somebody who just, you know, last weekend went out and talked about the context of Charlottesville and the Nazis that were out there. So they don't see him as a viable option. So they may just stay home. But, you know, this is something that we have to wait and see. It's still not the most important issue on the minds of most people in this young age group. That remains the economy.
Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis. This is why they are our signature panel. Thank you for the insights.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We welcome you. As we saw it coming, it was right at this time yesterday. Nathan Dean was sitting in this chair, and we were talking about the possibility of rescheduling cannabis being announced maybe even that day. And it happened about 5 minutes after Nathan walked out of the room. And here we are this morning on this 1st of May, afternoon, forgive me, watching Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, announce plans to reintroduce the Federal Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act. This would be to full-blown legalize marijuana in this country, removing cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act, which is something that polling shows a majority of Americans actually support, but no one sees happening quite yet. We're going to go one step at a time here, because what happened yesterday is very important. You can read about it on the terminal. The Justice Department recommending cannabis be reclassified as less risky, a very important step for cannabis businesses here who are also waiting for the Safe Banking Act. They can't use banks either to pass. And this is, of course, a bunch of states now that have done this, that have legalized marijuana. One congressman who was ahead of the curve on this issue, and it was way ahead, is Earl Blumenauer. State of Oregon, of course, was also ahead on this issue. He's the founder and co-chair now of the Congressional Cannabis Caucus, and he was out with a statement on rescheduling yesterday. Marijuana was scheduled more than 50 years ago, he writes, based on stigma, not science. And Congressman joins us now, live from Capitol Hill. Sir, I appreciate your being with us. I suspect this is a major development for you and the work that you've put into this, but I'd like to start at the beginning here. If it was based on stigma, not science, where did that come from? Was it, as we hear, tobacco companies? Was it racism, or was it both?
It is the aftermath of Richard Nixon's failed war on drugs. He weaponized cannabis in an effort to gain political advantage, demonizing young black men, young people generally, and being able to beat the drum of cannabis. It launched this 50-year war on drugs that had terrible consequences for a million young black men. It has stymied efforts to be able to move it forward. But the people insisted that they were going to take it in their own hands. We've now seen 38 states have legalized medical cannabis. We have 28 states that have fully legalized adult use. Many of these are by a vote of the people. We now have over 70% of the public that thinks that cannabis should be completely legalized. This decision by the Biden administration to deal with reality and schedule it as Schedule 3 rather than Schedule 1 is really extraordinarily important. It's going to allow state legal cannabis businesses to deduct their business expenses for tax purposes. Right now, That's they right. pay two, three times more than typical. So this is going to be earth-shattering. It's going to lead, I think, to the Safe Banking Act through the Senate in near future, and it's starting the revolution.
All of those would be big developments here. Your colleague, Steve Scalise, the majority leader, sees things rather differently, as, of course, you know, Congressman. He had this to say after the development on rescheduling. We need to be reducing the number of people that use drugs and not increasing that number. We should not be making matters worse, he said. Where's the disagreement here? Because you're talking about the war on drugs, and he is as well, Congressman. How would you respond to Steve Scalise?
Well, the states that have the most draconian drug laws have not reduced the use. In fact, states that don't have a system like we have in Oregon actually puts more risk for youngsters. Somebody who's getting their marijuana from a corner drug dealer, nobody checks ID, nobody deals with a license that they lose, and it's available in every state. Steve is just in the ozone. In fact, the majority of people in his own state support legalization. And having more draconian enforcement is not going to make a difference at all, other than it will disrupt some lives. This is an industry that now has almost 500,000 people. The industry is $40 billion, and that's just the legal business. So people like Steve are just out in the ozone. They haven't been able to stop it. Jeff Sessions, well. I'm sorry.
Not at all. It's just funny that I, you know, I'm talking to a lawmaker about this. Usually you say it's the people smoking pot who are in the ozone, but you're on the Ways and Means Committee, Congressman. This is a cultural issue. It's a business issue. And I think you're making the point here. This is also a taxation issue. As Chuck Schumer floats the this federal legalization effort here, I know that's not about to happen. I'm just curious, what would it mean? Do you have a number? What would it mean for revenues into the federal government if you legalize pot?
Well, first of all, having the reschedule to Schedule 3 means that it changes the equation for people with these businesses. They're not going to pay two, three, four times the typical tax. It means it's going to be easier to comply. It's going to take money-losing propositions and make them money-making propositions. This is going to mean hundreds of billions of dollars in the foreseeable future if we get this right. And of course, the health benefits are undeniable. That's why we have 38 states that have not waited for the federal government. They've taken medical marijuana in their own hands. So this is going to be revolutionary.
Talk about the amount of support that this has around the country, Congressman, and apparently in your own chamber. Is this something you talk about with your fellow lawmakers?
Yes. I mean, I've gone and beaten the drum, for example, on the Safe Banking Act. We had 321 representatives in both parties that voted for it twice. In fact, it's passed the House seven times. What's going to happen with what Chuck Schumer, Ron Wyden, Cory Booker, Sherrod Brown, Congressman Daines, or Senator Daines from Montana.
Yeah.
They're going to be putting this forward, and you're going to see that it will get probably 60, 65 votes. This is the most significant whip count that you're going to get. I think it's going to usher in a whole new era of rational drug policy.
Earl Blumenauer, Congressman from Oregon's 3rd Congressional District, we thank you for being with us. Sir, and we'll have more details as this wraps. It could take the rest of the year based on what we understand. There's a comment period and a final approval that needs to take place here. Let's assemble the panel for their take on this and some of the other stories popping today in Washington. Rick Davis is here along with Jeannie Shanzano, our signature panel, just like that. Bloomberg Politics contributors. Rick, this is not a Republican issue typically, and I just referenced what Steve Scalise said in the wake of this news here. Chuck Schumer, Cory Booker, and others right now, Ron Wyden, Democrats in the Senate, are talking about their bill to legalize marijuana. But this seems to be something that might be a bridge too far for your party. What do you think about what's happening right now?
Yeah, there's still quite a few senators and congressmen, Republicans, who agree with Stephen Scalise, which is we should be not encouraging more drug use in America. We should be encouraging less drug use in America. And I don't think anybody who lives in a state that has legalized marijuana, either for recreational purposes or for medicinal purposes, don't think that that hasn't increased the risk on the road, that's pernicious effect of walking down the street and getting a secondary high just to go in from meeting to meeting in New York City these days. And the reality of it is no one has really done empirical studies around the long-term health effects of marijuana. And so I just think for the purposes of the debate, sure, if it's going to be happening before it, it's an age-old Washington slogan. But the reality, too, is that just because a lot of wrong has been done through marijuana policy in the past doesn't mean that it expunges the record in the future.
Well, we're talking about a couple of different things here, Jeannie. Rescheduling is one. Safe banking is another. Whether, you know, in the case of rescheduling, you're allowing these existing companies that do have employees to actually take those tax deductions, allowing them through safe banking, which has not yet passed, to use the banking system. Both of those different than what Chuck Schumer is talking about now and actually legalizing this on the federal level. This is something that Joe Biden promised, though, on the campaign trail. Is this good politics? Rick just painted the picture for us. You walk out the door, God knows you're in New York, and you get punched in the face by cannabis smoke wherever you go. This is the new reality. Does the government need to catch up with it?
Yeah, you know, I think Joe Biden is one of the most moderate Democrats out there on this issue. He obviously has a personal tie to the issue of drug abuse, and it's something that helps explain, although not fully, why he has long been against decriminalization or legalization. But he also wants to take steps, which is what the administration is doing now, to reduce penalties, right? So, you know, these are the sort of small steps that he is taking and trying to thread this needle. And we have to see where it goes. But, you know, the reality here is that there's only so much the president and the administration can do. If you want to get real traction on this, it's got to come from Congress, just what you're showing in terms of Chuck Schumer. The Controlled Substance Act, that's got to be changed by Congress. The criminal code, got to be changed by Congress. And so there is going to be a, I think, a really heated, interesting debate on this issue for some of the reasons you just laid out and Rick was talking about, because we've heard a lot from the pro-legalization side so far and a little less from the anti. So I think that's going to be happening. But again, Joe Biden, these are small, important steps, but they're still small and allow him to walk this more moderate line.
Yeah, well, the word, though, Rick, is that, you know, the data here are stubborn. Most research shows that legalizing marijuana has not actually increased usage. Joe Biden just doesn't like the idea. He's from a different generation, and this just doesn't seem to be something that he wants to speak about in the way that people expected during the campaign. Does he need to be consistent on this? Does he put Kamala Harris in front of the issue? What do you do in a re-election campaign?
Yeah, I think it's the difference between being the president of the United States and having to set a trend and a moral center for the country versus being a candidate and, frankly, needing to shore up the base vote he's got, especially within the party of young people. And when you poll young people, this is a lopsided issue, right? They don't see the harm. They don't see the foul. They haven't been historically damaged by it. And so for them, this is a no-brainer, and anybody who gets in the way of this is just thinking about the past, not the future. And so it's a real hard line that the president has to pass through. And I'd say, you know, this is not a surprise to me that the administration would be changing the classification of this drug, you know, 6 months before a presidential election. Not saying it's a quid pro quo, but it certainly does soften up that 18 to 25 year old base within his party who's been reluctant to be enthusiastic about his presidency.
I do wonder about that, Jeannie, in our remaining couple of moments here. You're on campus, and the story on campus most recently has been a not good one for Joe Biden. As we watched police break up another encampment last night, 300 people arrested at Columbia University. Are you hearing talk about this? Is this a front burner issue for college students right now, or are they looking at the war in Gaza?
You know, when you look at the polls, the younger people are, the more supportive they are about making marijuana or cannabis accessible, decriminalizing it. There's no question there, a lot of support. But it's not something we've seen where people go out and vote on. Certainly when it's on a state level ballot, we've seen people who don't traditionally go out vote on it. But it's not in a federal level, something that we've seen really make a change. So I am not convinced that this is something that will help an awful lot. Do they support it? Absolutely. Will it get them out to vote? No. The economy reigns supreme when it comes to young people. Jobs, inflation, the economy. There's a lot of interest in Gaza, but even that is lower when you look at the most important issue polls.
I just think that's fascinating after, you know, so many years of people speculating on what the impact of something like this would be. It's still just young people want to be able to buy a house, right? It's pretty simple sometimes when it comes to politics.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Here in Washington, just a little ways down the road from where Joe and I right now, we're getting ready to read a statement from the Federal Reserve and ultimately have a press conference from Chairman Powell, Joe. And there's a real possibility that despite what we heard just weeks ago after a hot CPI report from President Biden, who said there will be rate cuts this year, that the chairman could indicate, in fact, there very well may not be.
Yeah. Or could there be a hike this year still to come? think there are 30% odds on that at the moment as we wait to hear from what we're told will be a much more hawkish Jay Powell. He's got a point to prove today, Kaylee, and it's based on the data. It's very hard to deny what's happening here in this economy, and it's something we wanted to spend some time with Lindsay Owens to talk about before we turn things over to our special Fed coverage. Lindsay is an economist at the Groundwork Collaborative, where she is executive director. And Lindsay, it's great to have you back. How concerned are you, knowing your background in economics here? You have a slightly more progressive view, and the idea of a more hawkish Fed at this stage, when you consider the impact that these rates have had higher for longer on the housing market, creating a higher barrier for entry for young people, more potential risk for the job market. What are we about to hear?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Powell is unlikely to veer off his higher for longer strategy, holding rates steady for now, but potentially coming off some of the earlier projections for September rate hikes. The question I think we have to ask ourselves here is, what are the benefits of a higher for longer strategy and what are the risks? And I do think given the areas where we're seeing sticky inflation, it's really unclear that the higher for longer strategy has a lot of payoff. When it comes to the housing market, when it comes to energy costs, when it comes to auto insurance, which is another one of the areas where we're seeing more inflation than we'd like, none of those are really responsive to the Fed's interest rate policy. And in fact, when it comes to the housing market, it may well be the case that the Federal Reserve's policies are exacerbating some of the pricing that we're seeing in the housing market. So I think the evidence that the higher for longer strategy is going to sort of bring down the last mile of inflation is thin. And I think the evidence that the higher for longer strategy is starting to post some considerable costs is getting stronger by the day.
Okay, Lindsay, your point is well taken that a lot of the stickiness is where you see most directly interest rate policy transmitting, as in higher rates, higher mortgage rates, that has ripple effects throughout the housing market, for example. But isn't the risk of not keeping rates higher for longer that rates going down or the expectation that they will go down further fuels demand, gets people out there spending, and all of those different areas of the economy where we're not talking about inflation getting sticky suddenly do start to see prices spiking higher again? Isn't that really the concern?
Yeah, absolutely. The Fed is trying to, handle the upside risk of inflation sort of, picking back up considerably, right? They're worried about that. I think we've seen a lot of inflation come down because of transitory factors and also because of supply coming back online. I don't think there's huge risk of, a big increase in consumption here that's going to have inflation sort of unmooring and sort of spiraling out of control. So I'm definitely in the camp of someone who actually thinks coming off interest rate hikes at this point, is smart. I would like to see cuts, frankly, given where we are in the cycle here. But we'll have to see sort of where Powell is at 2 o'clock. But at the end of the day, he's signaling that he's going to stick with the higher for longer strategy. And I think, we're all sort of watching this experiment play out in real time of the Fed trying to chase inflation down to 2% and hoping that they'll be successful. But increasingly, when we parse the individual data, it really doesn't look like this last mile is going to be responsive to interest rate hikes. And so I think we're in a real predicament here.
Does that last mile last through November? Because we've talked a lot about the political implications of interest rate changes around the election, and Joe Biden's got his eyes on about 6 months from now. Where are we in the cycle then, Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The political consequences of this really punishing interest rate environment are considerable. Americans' top concern about the economy right now is high prices, but they're also concerned about high borrowing costs. They're concerned about mortgage rates, which are incredibly high right now. I mean, look, I think sometimes we get focused on sort of watching mortgage rates tick up and down. But, let's think about what this means in real terms for families. I mean, I myself would be paying twice as much per month in today's interest rate environment than in the interest rate environment in which I bought my home. That is a considerable difference, right? Twice the monthly mortgage payment, right? So this is pushing folks you know, out of home ownership for years, right? Folks not being able to jump in to the mortgage market. So the effects of this are considerable on the economy. Of course, the economy is top of mind as folks head to the ballot box in November. And we also have to look at some of the other things that are influenced by the high interest rate environment. I mean, you know, Americans are holding a huge amount of debt right now. APRs on credit cards are sky high. And credit card companies are, you know, really in some ways hiding behind high federal fund rates to keep APRs really higher than they need to be. So I think this is affecting consumers, most consumers, many consumers in America every day, the high cost of borrowing. And it's absolutely the case that getting some relief on borrowing, I think would be really helpful for President Biden before November.
Lindsay, we have just about a minute left before we hand things over to our special coverage and about an hour until Chairman Powell walks up to that podium to deliver the press conference. If you had one question to ask him today, what would it be?
I mean, look, the question I have is, are we really getting payoff from higher for longer? What is your evidence that higher for longer is going to get that last mile of inflation down, that is going to get housing costs down, that is going to get energy costs down, that is going to get auto insurance premiums down? I think you've really got to ask yourself, is the juice worth the squeeze here in the high interest rate environment? And then if I got a follow-up question, I would sort of be interested in hearing him articulate the consequences of higher for longer, because I would hope he's well aware of the consequences here for American families.
All right, Lindsay Owens, Groundwork Collaborative Executive Director, former Senior Economic Policy Advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, thank you so much for joining us. It's an excellent question, Joe, about the way that monetary policy is transmitting in this economy, whether we can actually get down from 3% to 2%, or maybe the question Chairman Powell would like to answer least of all, is 2% still achievable?
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.